Oil has allowed us to move off the farm and into the city, where we now eat foods that have been trucked in from over 1,000 miles away. But this miracle of modern movement leads some to ask, who will feed us when we run out of gas?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 543rd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Cessnock who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Carol Stafford on the phones. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
Parmalee Taft.
Good morning.
Hello. Folks, a few months ago, I guess it was, I was cruising along I-40 outside of Gallup, New Mexico, when traffic came to a dead stop. After waiting a while, I climbed out of my car to have a look around and see what was going on, and what I saw was truly amazing. Stretching in each direction for as far as the eye could see along the high desert highway was trucks. Must have been a million of them or so, and they all were headed west toward L.A. Only how now those trucks weren't headed anywhere because, of course, they were stopped dead. And they were just sitting there, rumbling in neutral on diesel. I got into some what-if thinking. What if all of those trucks just simply were stopped and could no longer move freely about the land? And that, of course, leads us to the question of the day, which is, who will feed us when we run out of gas? Here to help us explore this hypothetical question, we have Richard Heinberg, who is the author of The Party's Over, and the instructor at New College in Santa Rosa, California. Richard, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Richard, you're the author of, I believe, 6 books, each of
which... Actually, it's going on 8 now.
Going on 8 now. You're moving right along. Well, it seems like all of these books are predicting a rather bleak future for our love affair with oil. Do you really believe that there will come a day when all those trucks will stop running because they're out of gas?
Oh, yes, definitely. And we'll probably have a few days like that from time to time just within the next few years. I don't think all the trucks will stop permanently anytime soon, but it's going to get more and more expensive to fuel them.
And you talk a lot about peak oil. What do you mean by peak oil?
Well, that's just the observation that every oil field... reaches a peak of production, and then production starts to decline. It's not as though we can just extract the oil at ever-increasing rates, and then one day, suddenly it all runs out. No, there's a kind of bell-shaped curve of production from any oil field in any country, such as the U.S. America used to be the world's foremost oil-producing nation in the early part of the 20th century. And we hit our peak of discovery in 1930. We've been discovering less and less oil in the U.S. since 1930. And then we reached peak of production in 1970. And ever since 1970, the U.S. has been producing less oil and importing more. So currently we're importing about two-thirds of the oil that we use, and this is happening in country after country.
Mm-hmm.
Chevron estimates that of about 48 significant oil-producing countries, about 33 are in decline. Just this last year, Mexico went into decline, and Mexico's largest oil field, which is the world's third-largest oil field, Cantarell in the Gulf of Mexico, started to go into decline, and it's declining at something like 8 to 10% a year. We could go right down the list. Australia.
Great Britain. Where your gloominess comes from, is looking at the numbers, then, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is not something that's hypothetical or theoretical. This is something that we're just watching in slow motion unfolding in front of us.
Well, you brought up some interesting dates. You talked about the 1930s, and, you know, there were a lot of us around who were alive back then.
Hmm.
And it kind of really talks to how recent our love affair with oil really is in terms of history.
Right.
It just hasn't been around, that we haven't used it for all of that long. And yet, it has had, our recent use of it has had a real profound impact on the way we feed ourselves, has it not?
Absolutely. Yeah, American agriculture has gone through basically three periods. During the first period, which started with the first European colonists arriving on the continent, we were increasing our food production mostly just by putting more land into production. We were forcing the native people off the land and
slashing and burning our way across the country, right?
Exactly, yeah. And that reached an end around 1920. And from about 1920 to about 1970 was a period of massive intensification of food production, using mechanization, farm machinery, and using new crop varieties, hybrid crop varieties, also using new kinds of pesticides and herbicides, and perhaps most important of all, chemical fertilizers made from fossil fuels.
Right.
So all of this...
So this is really when our love affair with oil comes into play then.
Right. And during this time, we managed to increase production per acre quite dramatically, at least three times. In other words, we were producing three times as much per acre by 1970 as we were by in 1920. And since 1970, we've gone into a kind of period of diminishing returns, where we're continuing to, in many cases, increase the inputs, but the increased yields are very marginal wherever they occur.
And how did that use of oil impact the lives of people? I mean, there was a time not too long ago when most of us lived on land, on the farms. And our use of oil has allowed us to replace people with machinery.
And, absolutely.
And so we the people just moved into town, right?
Right. Well, yeah, mechanization essentially forced people off the land. Even if you desperately wanted to farm back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you were competing against the people with bigger machines, and if you couldn't afford to buy a machine or go into debt to, and if you didn't have a big enough farm, you know, the scale of the enterprise just sort of made it more and more difficult for you to make a living. So most farmers went out of business. Back in 1900, something like 70% of the American population lived rurally and grew most of their own food.
Mm-hmm.
Today, something like 3% of Americans farm, and way less than 1% farm full-time and get all of their income off the farm.
And almost nobody gets all of their own food off their own farm anymore, correct?
Right, right. Yeah, so we've made an enormous shift over the last 100 years, and it's completely unprecedented in all of human history. I mean, even the great agricultural civilizations, going back to the Mesopotamians and the Romans and Mayans and all of those folks, most everybody was involved in food production, and then there was only a small portion of the population that were specialists and, you know, soldiers or priests or kings or whatever, and lived off everybody else. But now we've created a society where you've got 1% of the population, pretty much, producing all the food for everybody else, and then everybody else is involved in this dizzying array of occupations, you know, supermarket checkout person, you know, stockbroker, you could go on. I mean, thousands and thousands of occupations we've created for the burgeoning middle class that results from the mechanization of food production.
Well, to what extent, then, does this food production rely on oil?
Well, almost entirely. If you take the oil away, the whole thing comes to a crashing halt instantly. The chemical fertilizer is made from natural gas, and that's also a problem here in North America because we've passed our natural gas production. It's going into decline. Natural gas is getting more expensive. So, therefore, food fertilizer prices have shot up in recent years and even just in the recent months. But all the rest of it is mostly dependent on oil.
For the food to be grown requires oil. For it to be shipped to processing requires oil. For processing it requires oil. For shipping to market and packaging and driving home, it all requires oil.
Absolutely. And what doesn't require oil requires electricity, which is mostly coming from coal. So it's all fossil fuels, basically.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about oil, and we're asking the question of the day, which is, who will feed us when we run out of gas? You're invited to participate. We have Richard Heinberg from New College up in Santa Rosa, California, author of 8 books on oil and the food chain. So pick up your phones and join us today. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. We're back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking with Richard Heinberg, who is an instructor of the New College up in Santa Rosa, California. We're talking about the... what happens when we run out of oil? Who's going to feed us? I'm not the only one asking this question. It seems like there's a lot of people asking this question. Producer Carol Stafford came up and said there's a whole website called worldwithoutoil.org. And you look it up, and there's quite a community there asking pretty much the same question. What are we going to do when we run out of oil? Richard Heinberg, you made the assertion that the way we feed ourselves, our modern technology-intensive food chain, is entirely based on oil.
Right.
There's no doubt in your mind that that's the case?
Well, yeah.
No fudge factor at all, 100%? It's there, right?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. And, that can change, and it will change. But right now, if the oil were shut off tomorrow, the whole food system would just grind to a halt. And very quickly, the supermarkets would run out of food. They have typically 3 days' worth of supply. In other words, if the trucks stopped running, the shelves would be empty in 3 days.
Yeah.
The whole system is based on petroleum, and really cheap petroleum, because as the prices go up, that hits farmers first and foremost, and they're the most vulnerable link in the whole chain.
So let's go back to the notion of peak oil, and you say that every field of oil, every reservoir of oil, once you start pumping it, it reaches a peak someplace along the line, and then it starts to go into decline. How many, or what percentage of the world's oil fields are in decline now, do you think?
Oh, certainly a majority of the most productive fields are in decline. See, what's happened is we found the largest oil fields first.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, we were finding oil fields like Ghawar in Saudi Arabia, or Cantarell in the Gulf of Mexico, or Daqing in China, oil fields that would produce at peak production over 1 million barrels a day. The world uses, just for a sense of scale, the world's using about 85 million barrels of liquid fuel per day.
85 million barrels?
Yeah, and 5
and
million of that.
That's increasing dramatically, isn't it, with the... with China and India using...
Yes, it has. We have been increasing up until the last 2 or 3 years, but the high prices have forced a lot of folks off the out of the market. So what's happened over the last couple of years is that oil production has gone almost flat. And a lot of my colleagues, I should say, are looking at this and saying, well, the evidence seems to be mounting that we've reached peak production. And in fact, regular conventional crude oil seems to have peaked in May of 2005.
Hmm. Okay, so where we that would put us on the downhill slope of oil production then.
Right. Now, we may still see some marginal increases in unconventional liquid fuels like natural gas liquids, and we're seeing increase in production of biofuels right mm-hmm. now and so on. So when you add all of that together, we're still seeing some marginal increases in liquid fuels. But if you're talking about regular old crude oil, that may already be in decline.
Somebody made note of the fact in an email to me that the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, contain about 10 times as much oil as the proven reserves of Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And it's recoverable at $30 per barrel. Wouldn't that, it be a source of oil that would extend the life of our consumption for quite a while?
Not really. I could talk at some length about the tar sands of Canada. Yeah, there's an enormous resource there, but it's not oil. This stuff is it's bitumen, and it has to be cooked to make it into a kind of synthetic crude. So if you look at the energy that's required to mine the stuff and to to process it, to turn it into a synthetic oil, and then you take into account the fresh water that's needed
mm-hmm.
To process it and the natural gas that's used to cook the stuff, it ends up being in...
Well, they said it's recoverable at $30 a barrel.
Well, yes, but the problem is it's not a matter of just throwing more money in one end and you get more oil out the other. There are natural limits to mm-hmm. the rate at which we can recover this stuff. Canada is currently producing 1 million barrels a day from the tar sands. They have plans maybe to increase that to 2-3 million barrels a day by 2020. And that's probably as far as they'll ever get, because there are limits to the fresh water, there's limits to the natural gas that's available to process the stuff. And 1-3 million barrels a day is not chicken feed. That's an enormous amount of oil. But if you look at that from the global standpoint, even if you look at it from the standpoint of what the U.S. uses, which is about 20 million barrels of oil per day, that may be enough to offset some declines, from Mexico and maybe one or two other countries. But start looking a few years out, and it's not a solution to the problem.
Well, Richard Heidenberg does not seem to be offering any rainbows here in this situation at all, is he?
Well, the end result here is we've got to change the way we grow food. We've got to change our whole petroleum-dependent way of life, in fact, but we certainly have to start with the way we grow food, because that's the most essential part of the whole
equation,
right?
Well, you made the assertion that the way we eat now is entirely predicated on the oil, on the ready availability of cheap oil.
Well,
no cheap oil, then we're in trouble.
Just one gauge of that is the fact that, according to one study, on average, it takes about 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to grow 1 calorie of food. Now, that's a situation completely unprecedented in all of history, because always before, farmers had to basically make an energy profit on the process of growing food. That's what food production is all about. That's our most basic energy source, is the food that we eat. So if it takes you more energy to get the food than you get from the food, ordinarily that would spell extinction. But we're able to get around that because we have this one-time-only gift from nature of fossil fuels.
Is there no other way around this? I mean, don't you think that technology might afford us a way to end the use of oil before we run out of oil?
Well, essentially, that's what we have to do, but we have to do it through conservation. And yes, there are other energy technologies that we can use, and we could easily spend the rest of the show just talking about biofuels, but of course there's also the ways of producing electricity through wind, solar power, and so on. All of these things, with the exception of some of the biofuels like corn-based ethanol, these are things that we do need to invest in and increase and so on. But I don't think at this point we can fantasize about, having solar-powered farms that will enable us, everybody else, to continue their current way of life. And, you know, we'll just have a seamless transition. Nobody will even notice 25 years from now we'll all be living in an alternative energy economy, and nobody will even really remember how they got there. No, we've gone too far down the path of petroleum dependence, and we've waited much too long to make the energy transition. And so we have some bumps in the road ahead of us, and so we better prepare for those.
Okay, folks, fact number one, our food chain is totally dependent on the availability of cheap oil. Fact number two, we're running out of cheap oil in the world. So we look down the road, and what do we see? We ask ourselves the question, who will feed us when we run out of gas? Pick up your phone and join us today. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We've got Richard Heinberg and you, so pick up your phone and join us. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. Please do stay tuned. Well, fact number one, folks, the availability of our daily bread is totally dependent upon the availability of cheap fossil fuels. Fact number two, cheap fossil fuels are not as available as they once were, and are getting less available all the time. You don't have to look very far in the world to see the validity of that statement. I mean, my goodness, what it's taking us to survive in the Middle East these days is really quite extraordinary. So it looks like we're going to be having to ask ourselves this question, who will feed us when we run out of gas? Anxious to hear what you have to say. Our phone number today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have Richard Heinberg with us, who's an instructor at the New College in Santa Rosa, California, also the author of about 8 books on energy independence. I think why don't you name some of those titles?
Yeah, well, the three most recent ones are worth mentioning. One is called The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies.
Mm-hmm.
And the one after that came out in 2004 is called Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. And finally, my most recent book that came out last September is called The Oil Depletion Protocol, A Plan to Avert Oil Wars, Terrorism, and Economic Collapse.
Well, okay, we certainly want to know about that. We're going to go quickly to the phones right now before we get to your four plans on the future here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk with, we'll start off with Bruce. Bruce, welcome to The Food Chain.
Michael, great show.
Thank you.
I think it's the most important show on radio.
Well, we're honored.
Exactly. And now the thing is, this is such a big subject. I've had about 10 different thoughts. We're going to get into cellulosic ethanol pretty soon, and that should help. And on a farm, you know, they have all that waste anyway, the agricultural mm-hmm. waste. They should have a plant there to make it into ethanol. But you wrote a book about small farms.
Right.
And I think you're a prophet. I think that people closer to
town... Some people think I'm a heretic.
Well, anyway, people close to town should be able to take a small acreage and use, you know, because what you were talking about is making good money on small acreage
mm-hmm.
and on a competitive basis with today's crops. So in the future, when oil-based agriculture gets more expensive, it should be even more affordable.
Well, I think that's going to be one of the strategies Richard Heinberg brings up, right, Richard?
Yeah, we will need to return to smaller scale farming, and we're going to need a lot more people farming because as it becomes more expensive to operate that big farm machinery, we're going to have to go back to more hand labor and also more animal labor on the farm.
What prompted this call, I was driving along and coming home, and I was listening to the show, and have you ever seen those lawnmowers that are solar powered? They go until the sun goes down, and then they stop, and then they, you know, when the sun comes up. Now, I realize that plowing is different than mowing a lawn, but there was a Japanese farmer. Now, this is especially, I think, appropriate when it comes to grain. Fukuoka,
mm-hmm.
was it?
Mm-hmm.
The one about Fukuoka.
Yeah, who basically, I don't know if discovered, he was a lazy farmer. And he figured out a way to farm, I think, barley and rice in the same field without plowing.
Mm-hmm. And I think he called it the one straw revolution, wasn't it?
That's right.
The point about that is this country depends on grain. We need bread, we need flour, that kind of stuff. And so hopefully the transition from mechanized agriculture to something that's less mechanized can be easier. So you don't have to plow a field 10 or 12 times. Ever driven a tractor across a field for, you know, plowing 80 acres? What a mind-numbing experience that is.
Yeah, it's not too good for the land either.
Right, right. And so I guess what I'm saying is I don't think the future is as bleak as it is. Many people would think listening to the program. I think that we can make the transition if we just, you know, are intelligent. And there are a lot of smart folks out there.
Well, thanks for the optimism. We need some optimism this morning. And
you
Bruce
wait, Mike. If it's financially viable, it'll happen.
Okay, there you go. And that's absolutely right. Okay, let's go to Bob and check in with Bob and see what Bob has to say. Let's see if I can click the right button. Bob, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, hi. I consider your guests... lack of optimism to be very Castro-esque, if you will. This idea of going back to hand
Castro-esque?
Labor.
Did you say that? What is Castro-esque?
Castro-esque. Castro is all about going back to hand labor and animal labor to avoid dealing with the 21st century in order to protect his fiefdom.
Well, he also
so
probably...
To me, a quick gleaning of the technology that lies on the horizon, you know, it's like trying to figure out 100 years ago, could they have perceived where we are now? We went to the moon with essentially a pocket calculator, a computational ability, right? The old four-banger stuff.
Right.
But what's on the horizon now are the possibilities of deriving hydrogen from water by a couple of different processes, and these are easy to get info on the web. There's one using starch and enzymes, and there's another one that you can get. There's an article on it's been all over the place, but on CNET for sure, with gallium and aluminum. So who knows what lies ahead, even 20 years in terms of energy technology.
Well, I
think you're being very premature and insincere about the human capability.
Well, okay. Well, Richard, have you been called Castro-esque?
Well, I can assure you I'm not being insincere.
Thanks for the call, Bob.
There are lots of interesting new energy technologies out there. We could talk about wave power and ocean thermal power.
What about the notion that we have always come up with a solution that there is a solution out there, we just have to find it?
Well, see, that's the thing. We've become very optimistic over the last couple of centuries because we've been living in this period of time where we've had access to incredibly cheap energy and more of it every year that has enabled our economy to grow year after year, our population to grow, our productivity to grow. This is unique in all of human history, and it's due to this one-time-only gift of energy from fossil fuels.
So now, no fossil fuels, no optimism, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but we do have to have a sense of perspective. It's not as though human beings have always solved their problems. Civilizations have collapsed many times in the past. In fact, historians who study the situation would say that collapse is the inevitable end of every civilization that we've seen in history before.
Okay, now, we're going to have to take a quick break. Richard Heinberg, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for the hour. We're talking about oil. We're talking about what happens when we run out of gas. Who will feed us when we run out of gas? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back, and we'll go to the phones.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops,
organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks, and a special welcome to all of our new friends listening on AM 810 WEDO in beautiful Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I want to invite all of you to participate in the program whenever you want by logging on the forum page at metrofarm.com and letting us know what you think. And we do know that you do think. Richard Heinberg, we're back. We're on the phones. We're going to go quickly to Frank. Frank, welcome to the Food Chain. Are you there?
Hi, Michael. Great show and very timely. Your guest makes an excellent argument all the way up to the end and comes to a conclusion that I would take issue with. If we go the conservation route, the capacity, the carrying capacity is about 20% of what it is right now. So the amount of...
That's an excellent point. Let's have Richard address that. Richard?
I don't have much time.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Finish up then.
Also, he's correct when he's talking about these alternative energy sources like wind and solar. They are a drop in the bucket compared to the amount of energy that we consume and absolutely cannot replace it. If people are counting on a technological breakthrough, I'm not prepared to hope that it happens before the oil runs out, because it very well may not happen. I mean, I agree that there may be the nanotechnology for extraction of hydrogen and so forth, I don't think we should gamble the future of the country on it. So there's a book very powerfully argued by a fellow by the name of Morris called The Environmental Case for Nuclear Energy, and nuclear has been much maligned. Japan and France are using our designs for reactors to produce and export, and it's the only thing that's big enough to compete with oil. And if we switched over to nuclear for generating electricity, we could use that to manufacture hydrogen for cars, or just the fact that we don't have to burn oil to generate electricity would mean we could burn on natural gas to generate electricity. Means we can use natural gas to power our vehicles and let the electricity be produced from nuclear. And I'd like to take my answer on the radio, if that's all right.
Thank you very much for the excellent call, Frank. Really appreciate that. Boy, that was a lot of points that he made, Richard. What about the carrying capacity of conservation?
Well, his main point was about nuclear, and I'd like to address that.
Fire away.
An interesting study just came out for the German Parliament last year, which hasn't been challenged as far as I know, and in fact I've seen other studies that have come to essentially the same conclusion. The world's uranium supply is also a non-renewable resource, and currently uranium prices are skyrocketing. They were down around $7 in 1999 per pound.
But hey, I have a great idea.
It's about $120 per pound now. And so we're looking at a situation where we're likely to see a global uranium supply peak around 2025, 2030. So if we build hundreds, and it wouldn't take just another nuclear power plant or two. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of new nuclear power plants. If we built all of those nuclear power plants to replace the energy that we're currently getting from fossil fuels, we would run out of uranium very, very quickly.
Well, that might be good. That might be good, Richard, because if we run out of uranium, then we wouldn't be able to make bombs, right?
Well, that's true also. I'm sure the government would prioritize one thing.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
Let's try Kent. Kent, welcome to the Food Chain. You're on.
Yeah, I got two questions. One is, what is the current versus potential production of the Iraqi oil fields? And the other is methane hydride really completely impossible to use?
Right. Currently Iraq's producing, I don't know, a couple of million barrels a day, something like that. And if there were no political problems there, possibly that could be ramped up to 4 or 5 million barrels a day. Again, you know, the world uses 85 million barrels a day, and most of the world's countries that produce oil are in decline. So that could help the situation temporarily for a few years, but it's not a long-term solution. Methane hydrate is basically natural gas methane that's trapped in ice crystals, much of it under ocean sediment, and some of it in tundra in places like Alaska and northern Russia. And the problem with methane hydrate is nobody has figured out a way to harvest the stuff that wouldn't risk an ecological catastrophe. See, methane is about 20 times as dangerous a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. So if we try to harvest this stuff in a way that doesn't work, where a lot of it escapes, then we could cook, basically set up a feedback effect where it would cause more global warming, which would in turn melt the methane hydrates on a broad scale, and it's really the ultimate climate disaster. The short answer is nobody's harvesting methane hydrates now, and that's not likely to change anytime soon.
Okay, good. Thanks for the call, Ken. Ken, we'll get to you right after this quick break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking with Richard Heinberg about what happens when we run out of oil. Fact number one, our food chain is totally dependent on the availability of cheap oil. Fact number two, the availability of cheap oil is becoming increasingly problematic, and sooner or later, we are going to have to face the fact that we're going to run out of this stuff. So who's going to feed us when we run out of oil? When we get back, we're going to go to Ken and then ask Richard to tell us about his four basic strategies for looking into the future. Do stay tuned. Michael Olson, right back. Hey, we're back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Richard Heinberg. We're talking about what happens in a world without oil. And speaking of a world without oil, we have Ken from worldwithoutoil.org. Welcome to The Food Chain, Ken.
Hey, thanks. Good morning.
So how did you come up with this, worldwithoutoil.org?
Well, to talk a little bit about the site, essentially we are playing a kind of a serious game. We started to simulate online an oil shortage starting on April 30th of 2007. We're kind of running on a fast pace, so we're now in the 27th week of the crisis. But people can essentially go and see what an oil shortage might be like by going to worldwithoutoil.org. And the reason we're doing it is to call attention to the very issue that Richard is talking about, that we're very dependent upon oil. We're in a situation now where, oil could become a lot more expensive very quickly, and the repercussions of that we really haven't begun to imagine. And so that's what we're trying to accomplish at worldwithoutoil.org.
Very good. Now, who do you think is going to feed us when we run out of oil?
Well, I think that we can look at examples of what happened in Cuba and what happened in Russia when they had economic declines. And what happened in those places is people were forced to feed themselves, which they did to kind of varying degrees of success. But that essentially is what we're looking at, is kind of a breakdown of the whole, mass system, oil-based system for preparing food, and a reliance on people having to make do with what they can do on their own.
Thank you very much, Ken, from worldwithoutoil.org.
And, you know, we had a success with that back in World War II and World War I. We had the Victory Garden movement. Very quickly, people started, plowing up their lawns and backyards and golf courses and all kinds of places, the White House lawn. And before you know it, we were growing 40% of our fruits and vegetables in backyard gardens.
And it was all very local, too, wasn't it?
It can be done, but folks would be better off if they learn those skills now and start practicing.
Let's talk about your four broad strategies for the future without oil. Last one standing.
Yes, well, that's where we basically just fight over what's left, and that's that seems to be the course that the world is on right now. And if we follow that course, everyone loses, basically.
Waiting for a magic elixir.
We're also doing that. We're saying, as some of your callers were saying, well, you know, there's not a real problem here because somebody somewhere has some kind of magical energy source that will solve everything, and we'll just ignore the fact that currently that energy source is producing 0% of our commercial energy supply, and it'll take years and trillions of dollars to make a difference in that, and just assume that somehow everything will work out okay.
Building lifeboats.
Building lifeboats is, I think, a sensible response to the situation, and it basically means folks looking at their lifestyle and saying, okay, can this continue? And if not, what should I be doing that can continue in a low petroleum world?
And power down.
And power down is looking at our larger social structures. And at every governmental level, from the city council all the way up to the United Nations, looking at ways to proactively reduce our reliance on fossil fuels and develop an alternative low energy infrastructure for society.
And my solution would be to develop a voracious appetite for food with its farmer's face on it.
Absolutely.
You know, if we start patronizing farmers who are growing things locally, and we develop that whole world of local agriculture, perhaps, you know, they can provide a much better buffer than we would otherwise have. Richard Heinberg, thank you so much for joining us today and on the Food Chain. We appreciate it. And thank you.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you out there for tuning in. Remember, cheap food isn't. Now, go out and have some fun in the world and tune in next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.